And then you have another category. So that's one aspect of the new anti-Semitism. A second aspect is simply confusing any criticism of Israel with criticism of with anti-Semitism. Literally, I'm not saying it's done subtly. It's literally done that way. I mentioned that earlier. There are two European reports done on the anti-Semitism, and you can always rely on the Germans to come up with the looniest ones because they're the most politically correct on this particular issue. And they produced a report, I forgot, from one of the centers in Germany on the topic. And they give all their examples of anti-Semitism. So what are their examples? They say in Italy, at a meeting of the newly constituted Communist Party, people were seen wearing keffiyehs, you know, the Arab headscarf. That's proof of anti-Semitism. And there were books on display by Palestinian authors. I'm not saying they didn't say Protocols of Elders of Zion. They just said Palestinian authors. That's proof of anti-Semitism. Or they say in the case of Amsterdam, some of you may recall the episode during the siege of Jenin when the wife of the head of the European Bank, Greta Duisenberg, she hoisted a Palestinian flag on her balcony. That's pointed to as evidence of anti-Semitism. Well, if you use that standard, any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, well, then you're going to have a large chunk of anti-Semitism in Europe. The ADL puts out its surveys just a few weeks ago. There was that meeting in Berlin to discuss the new anti-Semitism where Powell went and all of that, you know, the whole show went to Berlin. And and the ADL put out its latest survey. And the survey showed that one-third of Europeans are anti-Semitic. Oh, yeah, it's true if you go by their survey. But you have to look at the questions they ask. They ask questions like, do you think Jews talk too much about the Holocaust? If you answered yes, you're anti-Semitic. Well, I'm sorry, I do think they talk too much about the Holocaust, if you ask my opinion. And then there's a question, do you think Jews are more loyal to their country or to Israel? Well, if you're a Zionist, you're supposed to believe they're more loyal to Israel. So that would make most Zionists anti-Semitic. That's the whole point. Your first loyalty is supposed to be to the Jewish state. So if you go by the ADL surveys, yeah, I think one-third is a conservative estimate. I would think it's probably closer to nine-tenths are anti-Semitic by their standard. And then there's the third category. There's the sheer fraud. There's the conflating of anti-Semitism with criticism of Israel. And then the third category, for lack of a better term, it's a category of the spillover. Namely, because Israel calls itself a Jewish state, because it legally defines itself as the sovereign state of the Jewish people, because world mainstream Jewish organizations overwhelmingly and uncritically support everything Israel says and does, it's unsurprising that people critical of Israel will then become critical of Jews, generally. Is it right? No. Is it source for shock? Well, hardly. I mean, I'm old enough to remember during the war in Vietnam where criticism of American policy spilled over into anti-Americanism. There was a famous book that came out in the 50s called The Ugly American, where dislike of American policy was conflated with disliking all Americans. It's not right, but it's certainly not source of a shock. Somebody from Germany certainly knows the spillover effect, namely criticism of Nazi policy, then became a criticism of all Germans and this anti-Teutonic hysteria, which endures to this day. It's not easy for a German outside Germany to say, I'm German. Is that right? No. Is it surprising? Not really, given the atrocities committed by the Nazis. It's wrong, but the spillover effect is not altogether surprising. And the same thing happened in the case of Israeli policy in particular, because it's a self-identified Jewish state and it has the overwhelming support, public support, of Jewish organizations around the world. That, to me, sort of exhausts the question of the new anti-Semitism. And that brings me to the last fabricated source of disagreement on the Israel, or fabricated source of disagreement on the Israel-Palestine conflict. The first one was the effort to mystify it. The second one was the playing of the Holocaust and now the new anti-Semitism card. And the third source of disagreement is, in many ways, it's a subject of a lot of amusement, I think. It's funny. But it's also, in many ways, the most depressing, the depressing aspect of the whole conflict. And that is, on the Israel-Palestine conflict, there is such a, when I say depressing, I don't mean the actual human tragedy there. I mean how it's played out here. In the case of the Israel-Palestine conflict, there's this vast proliferation on the subject of sheer, pristine fraud. And that's a real problem. Now, it's true that lots of things are published each day, each week, which are fraudulent and nonsense on any number of topics, probably on all topics, you know, even on the whether the earth is flat or not. You know, people are still committed to the idea that it is. So a lot of fraud is produced on all subjects, no doubt about it. But the Israel-Palestine conflict does have a peculiar quality. And the peculiar quality is, if you're in academic life, and I know you have my condolences if you are, if you're in academic life, there are certain mechanisms which sort of act as a preliminary filter, sorting out the nonsense from what has some virtue. You know, it's just a form of what you would call quality control. And they have mechanisms. In the natural sciences, and I suspect there are people here who are in the natural sciences, the mechanisms of quality control are quite formidable. And the main mechanism is you simply reproduce an experiment. If somebody claims to have found make substantial new claims about a particular field of his or her field of inquiry, the challenge always is, laboratories around the country, around the world now, they reproduce the experiment and see if they get the same results. And that's a form of quality control. We can separate out the quacks from the authentic practitioners of science. And generally speaking, it seems to work. I don't know anything about the field, and I'm fully, you know, I want to be honest about those things, but I remember there was a famous scandal of a professor from MIT who then became the president of the top research university in the United States, Rockefeller University, named Baltimore. How many people remember the Baltimore story? Anyone? Okay. And Baltimore was accused of fraud, and it became a big story. And the hero was this Irish woman, low-level employee who blew the whistle. It was a great story, you know, the stuff like Aaron Brockovich. How do you pronounce that? Brockovich? Brockovich. It was that kind of story. I loved it. You know, the little person bringing down the big person. It was terrific. And I remember I asked Professor Chomsky about it. So I said, well, what do you think? Isn't that a great story? He was very, you know, he didn't want to be aggressive about it. He says, I don't think that happened with the fraud. And he says, I know Baltimore quite well because he was at MIT. And he said, that just doesn't happen in science. I said, why not? He said, well, because whenever somebody makes a claim, within 24 hours, there are people all around the world trying to reproduce the results to see whether it's true or not. So it's very, very difficult to have fraud in science. I don't know if it's true, but I respect, you know, Professor Chomsky's opinion on the topic, and those of you who are natural scientists in the audience, you know, you can judge for yourself whether that's accurate. When you come to the areas in which I, you know, my professional life is devoted, they sometimes call them the social sciences, which is stupid because, you know, they're not sciences. Social studies, in those fields, we don't have those impressive mechanisms or those exacting mechanisms of quality control, but we have some things. If you're an academic and somebody comes to you and says and puts forth an aberrant argument, an unusual thesis or argument, you always give that skeptical look. First of all, it's partially jealousy. You know, he or she found something that, you know, you don't. You know, it's the eureka thing. And you look and you give that skeptical look. And the first question you ask, or one of the first questions you ask is, you know, who published that book? You know, that's a form of quality control. If you know it's a university press, it's peer reviewed. That's the fancy word for other professors have to read the manuscript before it gets published. If it's a mainstream reputable publisher like Random House or something like that, you assume that a good editor has gone through it. And then if it's a little press or a vanity press, you figure, yeah, maybe it's breathtaking because the author is a crackpot. And that's a form of quality control. So, you know, my experience was I walked in and I saw Harper and Row publish this book. That was the first signal, there's something serious here. And I told you at the beginning of my remarks, I said the next thing I did, you may recall, I said is I flipped to the back to see who blurbed the book. Because in academic life, the next question you typically ask is, who blurbed the book? And you turn to the back and you check, you know, whether these are reputable authorities who have lent their name and their position to a book. That's a second kind of quality control. And then the third typically is, you know, people can disagree with me because I'm sure there are academics in the audience. The third is you ask, who reviewed the book? You're curious about the reviews. And what quality, you know, review they got. And those are all kinds of quality control. I'm not saying they work perfectly. I'm not saying they're excellent. You know, Professor Chomsky, he published with small publishing houses out of choice. In Canada, it was mostly, what was the anarchist press he published with? Black Rose. Black Rose in the United States, South End, as a matter of commitment and choice. He went with a small publishing house, and nonetheless, the work is, I think, most people, normal people will agree, is a quality work. Somebody who I'll get to in a moment, Alan Dershowitz, he's been on the offensive against me, and he says that, you know, Finkelstein has never gotten an article published by a peer-reviewed journal, and it's not far off the mark. I mean, I can make counterclaims, but it's not far off the mark. That's true, and I never even bother submitting because I know if my peers ever reviewed what I had to say, you know, it would come back probably covered in blood. So I don't even bother. So I'm not saying the mechanism works perfectly, but it's an imperfect mechanism nonetheless, imperfect but nonetheless works to some extent. But there's a very unusual thing that happens, and I think it is unusual, when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict. That is, you can have a book published by an excellent publisher. It can receive excellent blurbs when you turn to the back. It can receive excellent reviews. And all that being said, it can yet still be sheer fraud. And that's unusual.